Silent clapping.
Hello, everybody. my name's Owen. I'm a little nervous. I've never done this on Zoom, and I don't know. I've got a few butterflies, but I'm sure they'll calm down. As Kim said, well, first of all, let me say thank you, Kim. Thank you, Raleigh. Thank you, Janine. The three of them had asked me to do this, and I'm happy to do this. It's actually an honor to do this, to do the first District 14 Zoom meeting. Wow. So as I said, my name is Owen. I'm in my 17th year of sobriety, and I'm in my 15th year being a member of Al-Anon. I have gone through the steps in AA, and I've gone through the steps in Al-Anon, and I have sponsored both people in both programs. And I want to say that the very first time I went to the District 14 meeting, I was completely blown away. And I was blown away because there was a big group of Alateens there. There must have been, I think they might have been from Akalani School District. I don't remember for sure, but there were probably 30 kids there. And I remember looking around the room, looking at those 30 kids and thinking, my God, if it could have been like this for me in high school, what a wonderful thing that would have been. What a gift to see all those kids there and their honesty and their ability to see was, it just really, really touched my heart. And so that's always really struck with me, and it's been a very, very powerful chord in my sobriety. And it's funny how things in sobriety and in recovery can be so impactful. And I just never forget that first meeting with those kids there. Anyway, so I grew up in an alcoholic family. My father was the alcoholic, and I have very few memories from my early childhood, and I've learned in the program that's unusual. I don't have a lot, but the first one I have is it was New Year's Day, and my birthday's in February, so I would have been 2 years and 10 months old. And I'm in the dining room and I'm coloring with a crayon on the maple floor under the dining room table. And it's probably about 10 o'clock in the morning. And I remember it so vividly. I'm there with my sister and my dad comes in and he has these cocktail swizzle things that are like a little parachute, and you could blow them through a straw and they would fly up in the air and they would come down like these parachutes. And I remember my dad doing that and trying to entertain my sister and myself. And I remember completely feeling mom is angry with dad. Mom, that's all I knew, was that mom was really, really angry with dad on New Year's Day and that something was wrong. And that's the first childhood recollection that I have. And most of my early childhood recollections from the age of, you know, from a little toddler to the age of 12 are like that. They're just little snippets. Another one I remember is we went on this big road trip, and I think for my parents it was to try to repair the relationship. And I remember my dad pulled out this case, and it had liquor in it, and it had a couple of glasses in it, and I was maybe 9 years old. And I remember him trying to talk my mom into having a drink with him. And I remember, you know, my mom refusing the drink. And I remember my dad saying, you're no fun. You're no fun. And you know, it's funny. I don't know. I have a sister. I have a brother. I don't know that they would even, I don't know if my sister would even recall those two stories. Because when I talked to them about our childhood, you would swear we were all from different families. What I experienced, what my sister experienced, what my brother experienced, all a little different. But I'm the middle child, and we grew up in this little town outside of Montreal in Quebec. My dad was a pianist and an organist, and he was well known. And I would hear these whispers about what my dad had done. And so what I would try to do is I was quiet. I kind of hid. I didn't want people to know about my life, didn't want them to know about my childhood. I always mowed the lawn. I always changed the screen windows in the summertime to the storm windows in the wintertime. I was the guy that painted the front of the house. I didn't want anybody to know about the problems at home. And it was very, very, it was very, very embarrassing. It was very, very, very isolating. And what happened is I tried very, very hard to relate to my father. And my father would have, he'd have these parties at the house on a Saturday, and he'd have people over, and they would play records, and I would sit there in that living room, and I would, you know, try to be part of that adult scene, just because I really wanted a dad. And what I'm telling you today, I didn't realize until too many years later that that's what I was seeking. One of the things that happened during that period of time was my dad attempted to get sober, and he went to this program at a clinic in Montreal, and he was there for 30 days, I think. I was 12 at the time, and he got sober, and he got the sponsor, and he was going to these AA meetings, and he had these new friends. And I remember one day my mom said, his name was Reg, my father's name was Reg, and my mom said, "Reg, why can't you stay home? You're so busy helping all those other alcoholics. You put us through hell. Why can't you stay here and be with us?" And that memory has always cut like a knife. And about 2 or 3 months after that, it was winter time, and I'm in the kitchen. Kitchen's the warmest part of our house. It's January and it's cold outside. So my brother and I are in the kitchen, and my sister is off at university, and it's just us. And it's 6 o'clock at night, and Dad hasn't come home. And Mom's got something cooking on the stove, and we have this little built-in thing, this little built-in area, sitting area, and my brother and I are sitting there, and nobody's saying a word. Dad has not come home. And you can cut the atmosphere with a knife. And finally, Dad comes home about 8 o'clock at night. He comes in the door and he's drunk. And we have this linoleum floor, and he takes these coins out of his pocket and he throws them on the floor for my brother and I to run down and grab. And I remember feeling relief. It's finally over. He's back to drinking. Everything's normal again. I couldn't believe that he could actually make it. And that's sort of what it was like. That's what that whole thing was like. So for me, I used alcohol as a coping mechanism and as a way of controlling my alcoholism when it got out of control. I thought I would use drugs for a while and that would moderate the alcohol. And I did that for several decades. What I want to say about that briefly is that my dad did struggle and he did try again to get sober. And when he tried to get sober again, when I was 14 years old, he took me to some AA meetings with him. And I went to those AA meetings with my father and his sponsor. And it was at the Sailor's Church in Montreal. And I'm a 14-year-old kid, and I walk in the room, and there are all these people there, and they seem to be ancient. And, you know, this is from the eyes of a 14-year-old. You know, they're Czechs, they're Yugoslavs, they're Russians, they're Cubans, they're Americans, they're Chinese, at the Sailor's Church, all coming in off the ships and coming to this AA meeting. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking to myself, what am I doing here? I don't belong here. I don't understand these people. They're all speaking different languages, smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee. Now, why am I telling you that? I'm telling you that for what I think is a very important reason. And that's this, that Al-Anon is a gift. AA is a gift. And they work. And they work for people when approached properly, when given the opportunity to explore. And so the result for me of going to those meetings was that, number one, my father relapsed. He never got sober again and he died drunk. So number one, for me as a teenager, AA didn't work. There was no solution. And that experience that I had, unlike the experience I described earlier with the kids coming to the Alateen meeting. Unlike that, that experience that I had taught me that recovery doesn't work. And what that did for me is it just kept me out there for 30 years longer than it needed to, because I just didn't see that there was a solution. And so for me to find a solution in my particular case, I had to go to a rehab. And in that rehab, they had to pound it into me before I would be open to both AA and Al-Anon. And, you know, I'm very, very fortunate that that's happened to me, but it does make me wonder just how many people there are out there that haven't been fortunate enough to find what I have found. So my message in that is that I really try and listen. I really try and listen to whoever it is that's talking to me and try to listen about their pain and their situation and think, you know, am I the right person to help them? And if I'm not, who do I know out there that is? Who do I know out there that can relate to this person and help them? And I always encourage people to try more than one meeting. Try a multitude of meetings. And not only try a multitude of meetings, try the same meeting two or three times, because maybe that day you went there, for some reason, the dynamics just weren't right. So try it again, but don't sell yourself short. Wait for the miracle to happen. So I'm about 2 years sober, and this lady comes up to me at this recovery center where I've been volunteering. She looks at me and she says to me, she says, you know, Owen, you're angry with your dad. And it was an avalanche of revelation. See, it wasn't even denial. It was, I didn't even know. I wasn't suppressing it. When somebody said it to me, it was instant. Oh, you're right. Of course I'm angry with him. Why didn't I know that? And that started a journey that I want to speak a little bit about, because it relates to the steps. It relates to the the steps, whether they be Al-Anon steps or whether they be AA steps. So as a result, I started going to Al-Anon. But in addition to that, I was told, well, you've got enough sobriety now. You can start to look at your family of origin. And I always thought this family of origin stuff was just a bunch of fluff. You know, it really wasn't very important. And I did 3 years of one-on-one ACA counseling with a counselor who specialized in that. And we started out going, you know, once a week. And at the end of the three-year period, it was, you know, it was once a month. But it was, I think it was actually twice a week we started with, and then it gradually tapered off over time. But I learned so much about how growing up in an alcoholic family affects your thinking. And if you understand how your thinking is affected, then you can start to begin to understand what it is that you need to change. That's the difficult thing in this program. You know, it's a very, very simple program. But, you know, finding the key, finding what it is I really need to look at, being willing to change it, being willing to act as if it has changed before it has changed has been a key for me. When somebody when somebody said to me, let your wife be right, even when I'm convinced she's wrong, let her be right. Let her be right. Let it happen so that I can start to see the other side. I can start to put myself in somebody else's shoes. That's been a real, real big deal for me. So I was at an Al-Anon meeting a couple of weeks ago, and we're reading the history of Al-Anon. And on page 147 of How Al-Anon Works, it mentions Norman Vincent Peale and Dale Carnegie. And when that was read, another one of those little snippets from my childhood was remembered. Something that was buried and I had forgotten for years, and that it just, I read that and it turned on the light. And I remember my mother and a lady that lived up the street always talking about Norman Vincent Peale and Dale Carnegie. And this woman up the street, her name was Mrs. Kennedy. She had four kids, and her husband was an alcoholic, just like my husband, my father. But the difference was, he worked on a ship, and he was gone for 3 months at a time. So I could go up to her house, sit in her home with her boys in an alcoholic family where they had experienced alcoholism. They were struggling with what to do. They were reading Norman Vincent Peale. They were reading other books on self-help. My mom would come up occasionally, and it was a safe harbor. And as I think back on that, for me, it wasn't Al-Anon and it wasn't Al-Ateen, but it was something. It was something. And it actually makes me have more compassion for my mother. And it I have a great sense of gratitude for the tools that I've been given, and for the path that has been put in front of me. Excuse me for a minute. So, one of my jobs as a child was bail out dad. Your job is to bail out dad. So So when Dad started drinking again, my job was go down to the bar, pick up Dad, drive him home. And, you know, I started doing that at about the age of 14, 15. And I'm going to tell you, that experience has really helped me out with boundaries in later life. And it's helped me out with boundaries in later life because what I realized is that what my family did is we loved my father to death. We allowed him to, he had no consequences. He was cuddled and basically, you know, just allowed to drink himself to death, which is what he did. And seeing the effects of that later in life has helped me out tremendously. I have two children, and one of my children is one of my qualifiers, and had a long struggle with drug addiction. And my experience with that early childhood has allowed me to feel good and secure in setting firm boundaries, which I'll talk about in a minute. So things went from bad to worse in my childhood, and my parents basically lost their home. And you know, in the early 60s, losing your home in Quebec was not something that typically happened to people, and that created a situation for me where, for many, many years, economic insecurity was a big issue. And being able to earn enough, have enough, and be okay and not be frightened was a big deal. And today I don't worry about that. I've been able to turn that one over. So I go through life, I go to university, I work my way through university, I meter my drug use, and I work really hard and I work really, really fast, and I get through it in record time. And the reason I do that and get through it, get fast in record time is two things. One is I know that if I don't do it quickly, my addiction's going to take over and I'll never get it done. And two, I want to be able to get the hell away and never, ever see my family again. I just want to get the hell out. And that's what I did. That is what I did. And I met a woman. We got married. We worked. We traveled around the world. We had two children. I have two children with that woman. And basically, I burnt that marriage down through my drug addiction and alcoholism. We came to California because she had a brother here, and I've been here ever since. When I got sober, my youngest was 18, and my eldest was 21. And I'm going to tell you that one of the greatest gifts my eldest ever gave me was when I got sober, he wouldn't talk to me. And he didn't talk to me for 3.5 years. And that was a gift that continues to give today, because what that gift told me was, Dad, I love you so much that I can't afford to watch you struggle. I am too emotionally close to you. I don't want to see you fail. It's too hard. So until you prove to me that you've got a solid track record in sobriety, I am not going to have anything to do with you. And that's an important message for Al-Anon. That's an important message. And that's a message that I had to deliver in a different way, but a similar fashion to my younger son. And one day, I'm 3.5 years sober, he calls me on the phone and he says to me, and he knows I like photography, and he says to me, he says, Dad, what kind of camera do you think I should buy? And that was the first I'd really heard from him in all that time. And I will say to you that 2.5 years ago, my son moved from New York to California, and he called me up and he said, "Hey, Dad, I got this deal with my company. They'll pay for everything, and they'll ship me out, or they'll give me a little more money, but I have to drive myself across country and take myself across country." He said, I'm thinking about driving across country. Would you do it with me?" It took a nanosecond to say yes, just a nanosecond. And I remember I got to New York, and I'm looking at my son, and I'm saying, "Hey, I want you to know I don't know how to do this." And he says, "I don't know how to do it either." "Oh, we'll fake it. And it was a great experience because I'm sober, I'm clean at the time, I'm 15 years sober, and we can both admit to each other that we just don't really know how to relate to each other very well. But we're gonna drive across this country, and we're gonna figure it out, and we're gonna do the best we can do with it. I couldn't have done that if it hadn't been for this program. If it hadn't been for being able to act and behave as if the change has occurred even before the change occurred. So what I when I was in this early sobriety, I had been volunteering over for the Center for Recovery at John Muir, and my son had gone AWOL, my younger son, and he'd been gone for a long time, and about 18 months, and I'm still sober. And this lady over there comes up to me and she says, "You know, we have a family group over here, and it's for people who are struggling with addicts in their family, whether they be alcoholics or drug addicts who are trying to figure out what to do." And she said to me, she said, "You know, you're still sober and your son's AWOL. You don't know whether he's dead or alive." She said, "I'd like you to come to our program, and I'd like you to volunteer on Saturdays if you will." And I've been there every Saturday with the exception of this COVID thing, every Saturday without fail, unless I'm out of town for some reason. And it has indeed been a gift for me to be over there and to talk to people. And I've met a lot of good people through that. And we've had a lot of cross-fertilization between Dad and Al-Anon. So with that, I want to talk about the steps for a minute. I mentioned to you earlier in this call, in this talk, that I went to ACA for about 3 years. So I'm going through this ACA for 3 years, and I'm working with a sponsor, and we're going through all the steps. And I'm also in the support group with 5 other people. I'm doing all this stuff, you know. I'm doing Al-Anon, I'm doing AA. I got this therapist, I got this support group we're meeting with. And in the support group, we're all dealing with, some issue with a family member. And, you know, so I'm with these 5 people, and mine is forgiving my dad. You know, and I go through this burning bowl ceremony, and I write on it, "If you really believe you've accomplished it, you write on a piece of paper what you've done." So I wrote on this piece of paper, "I forgive my dad." I fold it, take a book of matches, and I light it, drop it in the bowl. I'm done with this. I'm done with this. Success. Well, that summer, I was supposed to go on a motorcycle trip to Sturgis, South Dakota with some people. We had this house rented. That summer, also, was my wife's father's 90th birthday. Now, I know enough to not ask my sponsor whether I should, you know, go on the motorcycle trip or go to the 90th birthday. I mean, I know the answer. And so what ends up happening is the 90th birthday is in Kansas. So it ends up that I actually take my motorcycle and I ride to this motorcycle rally, and then I ride from there and I make it to this 90th birthday party. And I'm at this 90th birthday party, and my father-in-law says to me, and this is in Kansas, he says, look at this. He says, look at this ad in the paper. And there's this ad in the newspaper for a $99 return trip from Kansas City to Toronto, Canada, screaming deal. And he says, my father-in-law says to me, isn't your mom up there with your brother? Aren't they up there somewhere? And I said, yeah, they are. And so I park my bike in the barn at somebody's apple orchard, and I get on this plane and I fly up to Toronto, which is where I went to university there. And I hadn't been there in, I don't know, 25 years, maybe longer, 30 years, let's call it. And the city has grown and it's changed. And I rent this car and I drive way north to my brother's place. And my mom is there. And you know what? It's the first time I'd ever been to my brother's house. Think about that. First time. That's what happens in an alcoholic family. You know, people get shattered. People leave. They're gone. Anyway, he lives in this little house on a lake. And my mom's there. My sister had drove up. She's there with my brother. And my brother-in-law is there. My mom. And I get to spend some time with my mom. I have a bunch of old photographs that I brought with me, or they had up there or something like that. I can't remember how it happened, but had these old photographs, and they were with my mom from before we were born, you know, sometime in the 30s. And I'm sitting beside my mom and I'm thinking, how do you make amends to a woman in her 90s? How do you do this? And, you know, and I just sat there and I had those photographs and I would say, Mom, who's this? Who's that? Tell me who these people are. And, you know, as a parent, my mom knew I was okay. My mom knew that I cared. My mom knew that I was coherent. My mom knew that I had an interest. You know, and that was enough. That was enough. So I'm driving back and I'm trying to make my airplane get and I'm coming down through from Northern Ontario down into Toronto area, and I get lost and I take the wrong exit off the freeway. And I'm driving by the cemetery. And I go by the cemetery. A little voice says, I think your dad's buried in there. And I ignore it. I go another block. A little voice says, turn around. And so I turn around and I go into the cemetery, and it's a large cemetery. And it takes me about 15 minutes and I find the office. And I say, I think my dad is buried here. What's his name, sir? And I give him his name. And I said, it would have been January 6th, 1980. And they look it up and they say, yes, he's in quadrant 47, tombstone 1192 or something like that. And they give me a map and I drive through this place and I go up to this tombstone. And there's an oak tree. And I sit there and I lean against that oak tree and I tell this tombstone, or I tell my dad everything that's happened in my life. I tell him he's got grandkids. I tell him what's happened. tell him about the marriage and the failure and the remarriage. I just tell him everything. And I get up and I walk over to my car and I break down and I cry and I cry and I cry. It was at that point that I'd forgiven my father. And you see, I thought I'd done it with that burning bush or that burning bowl thing. And you know, what it's taught me, what that really taught me is sometimes we think we're through the steps and we think we've got the results, but they're not really done yet. We're not finished with you yet, sir. You haven't dug deep enough. You're almost there. You're making progress, but you're not there yet. And what that enabled me to do was, what enabled me to take this book, I'm going to call this the book of my life, you know, with this, all this ACA stuff in it, all this step work. That's a highlighted book. You know, it's underlined. The pages are dog-eared. I take that book and I can close it and I can put it up on the shelf and I can move on. And, you know, when you think about spirituality and you think about applied spirituality, think about all those events, think about all that stuff. You know, I was just planning to go on a motorcycle trip in South Dakota. And then I got to go to my father-in-law's 90th birthday. Then I got to fly in an airplane. Then I got to see my brother. Then I got to make amends to my mom. Then I got to forgive my father. I didn't plan any of it. I did not plan any of it. It was all put in front of me when I was ready. When I was ready, and I was at the edge, and I just couldn't stand it any longer, it was put in front of me. And that's how it happened. That's how it happened. So all of this has really, really helped me with my relationship with my my younger son, and it really, really helped me create some boundaries. You know, his addiction took him to places behind bars, and I had an agreement with him, and I've got 11 points. I just pulled up the agreement. I thought I would print it before tonight, but this was an agreement, a contract between me and my son. And here's what it says. No drugs, alcohol in the house at any time. Friends not to visit without prior discussion. If I'm uncomfortable with your behavior, I'm going to ask you to leave. If you violate your parole, I will not lie and I will tell the parole officer. We agreed on a general time that he had to be home. If he was going to be late, he had to call me. This means I'm not checking up on you. It just means that I don't want to worry about you or about something happening because I need my sleep. I need to go to bed. I need my sleep. You are responsible for your own laundry. You are responsible for cleaning up your mess in the kitchen. If you borrow any tools out of the garage, you tell me. And you bring them back and you put them in the same place you borrowed them from. You must actively be seeking employment or you must actively be seeking school. Any one of those violated, you can't live in my house. And I remember before we had gotten to that point, we had gotten to a place where it was his third rehab. And he comes out of that rehab and they had burned all his clothes because there was just blood all over everything, you know, they had incinerated everything. And so he's there in this rehab out in El Sobrante and wearing a gown. And I bought him a pair of jeans and two t-shirts. That's all I bought him. And I hooked him up with a friend of mine who's a landscape contractor who had an extra room in his house where he could stay. And he could work for that guy. And that wasn't the final time that my son finally got sober, but he was clean for about a year. And that was a very special year for me at that time. And I remember he came to me when he had about 10 months clean. And he said to me, he said, "Dad, if you had done anything other than just the two t-shirts and the jeans, I would have never made it. Thank you. Thank you." Well, I don't know how much time I've got. How much time have I spoken? Got a couple more.
Yeah, you're good.
I'm good? Yeah. I got just two more that I want to share with you.
That's fine.
There's two more. Here's the first one. A couple of years ago, one of the guys I sponsor, his wife got really, really sick, and she had to have a very, very serious operation. And I was going to Spain, going for a walk in Spain with a couple of friends of ours. We did the El Camino walk, and I will tell you that that's a really good place to go. And if you're trying to think about a direction in your life and you want a space and you want some time to think through what you're going to do next, it's a really good place to do that. Anyway, we're going on this walk, and that's why we're in Spain. But before the walk, we're spending a week in Barcelona. And my friends, my sponsee's wife, was going to have surgery while we were in Barcelona. And I told him, I said, "I'll tell you what, let's synchronize our watches for exactly when she's going to have that surgery. And what I'll do is a half hour before the surgery, I'll find some place in Barcelona." I said, "I don't know where it is. I'll find something. And I'm going to go pray for your wife." And we're there with the other couple and we're walking around. And there's, this big cathedral in Barcelona. And, it's the usual thing. If you've been to Europe, you may know they've got these cathedrals. There's guys with balloons out front. There's vendors. There's lines. And you can go visit the stained glass and look inside and pay a fee. And a little long line of people doing all of that. And we're there. And I just said to the others, I said, I got something I got to do. I promised this guy I was going to pray for him. I just need a few minutes. Anyway, so I'm looking at the church. And over on the side of the church, there's a small door, and it says, for parishioners or people wishing to go to service only. So I open the door, and I go in there, and there's this guy up there, and there's about, 13 Spanish people from Barcelona. They're all praying. They're going through some kind of service. So I get down on one of these pews, and I just start praying for my friend and his wife. And I'm only there a few minutes, and the service ends. And the fellow conducting the service comes up to me, and he says, in English, what are you doing here, sir? He says, "I'm praying for my friend's wife, who's about to have surgery." And he says, "I'm the bishop of Barcelona. Come with me." And he takes me into the inner sanctum inside the church in Barcelona, where there's a garden that they've been growing since the 11th century. And we're in that sanctuary, and he puts his hands on my shoulders, and he prays for my sponsee's wife. And he says to me, "You text him now, and you tell him everything's going to be okay." I tell you, the gifts of this program are just amazing. I can't put a price tag on that. We have a choice. Our choice is we can allow this addiction and our situation, we can allow ourselves to become victims, or we can allow ourselves to be of service. And I tell you, being of service has—it's allowed me to grow up. It's allowed me to grow up, and it's allowed me to have a much richer life than I could have ever imagined. Last thing. I learned yesterday morning that my younger son will be going into the hospital on Tuesday for cancer treatment. And I want to tell you that I'm okay with it and I'm not too worried about it. And I'll tell you why I'm not too worried about it. I know that God's not done with him yet. He'll be fine. And with that, I want to thank you for listening.
Thank you so much, Owen. We really appreciate you sharing your experience, strength, and hope. I'd also like to thank you for Monday, 7:30 of St. Bonaventure Concord Group for hosting.